right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again, and Dom, something a bit different today. We are going to be talking not about reality television. We are going to be talking about a relatively recent, at the time of this recording at least, smash hit on Netflix, one of the biggest shows probably of the entire calendar year of 2020, The Queen's Gambit. And Dom, I guess before we even get into the fire takes, as far as all that is concerned, let me not, of course, forget to ask how you are doing, sir.
I'm doing great, and here and ready to talk about some fantasy television.
Okay, perfect. I am excited about the way this may play out. If the article that I just read, written by you, is any sort of preview here, I would be remiss not to give you an opportunity at the top of the show to direct the people to what I'm mentioning here, because this is not your first time reviewing The Queen's Gambit.
No, so I did write a more long-form piece about it over on myentertainmentworld.ca, and you can find the link to that on my Twitter feed, twitter.com/domhrv. But this will be a hopefully somewhat abridged summary of the criticisms in there, and I'm sure you'll have your own stuff that I can bounce off as well.
One thing, I promise this will be quick. I hope this will be quick. I shouldn't promise. Are you officially bailing on twitter.co.uk?
Twitter.co.uk. I think that ship has sailed at this point.
Okay, I certainly recall in the early years of this podcast that being a point of contention for us in a couple of different respects there. But Dom, I'm glad to see you've finally seen the light there. But for anyone unfamiliar, The Queen's Gambit, as I mentioned, I'm guessing pretty much everyone out there has at least heard of it in passing, but if not, a 7-part Netflix miniseries that came out at this point a couple of months ago, and really gained a lot of popularity, and in so doing has kind of sparked a lot of interest in the game of chess itself, as I'm sure we will be getting into. But Dom, I was not even aware of this until reading your article. Apparently this is based on a book.
Yeah, so it's based on a book by Walter Tevis, who has a lot of other notable works to his name. A book from, I think, 1983. And I think the book gained some popularity at the time, but it was never like a smash hit or anything. But this adaptation for Netflix really has taken the world by storm. Single-handedly responsible for a chess boom. Sales of chess sets over the holiday season have been at an all-time high, basically just as a result of this, as far as people can tell. So this is the new craze, sweeping the nation, sweeping the world, and I don't get it. I watched the whole thing, and it's fun. It's an enjoyable viewing experience, but it just feels it's like comfort food, basically. You just lay back and you let it envelop you in its warm embrace, and you just don't have to think about it too hard.
So I want to come clean right away. I did watch the first 6 episodes of this, and in a still relatively rare move for me, but a maneuver that I am implementing increasingly and enjoying the results of it, I gave up. I just didn't find myself compelled to watch what I thought and eventually found out was going to be the final episode of it. I didn't actively dislike the show along the way. I just felt like the ending itself was going to be pretty straightforward. And it sounds to me, based on having read your article, like that is mostly the case. But definitely want to flag up at the top of this podcast, huge possible oversight by me coming in here to discuss this, not having seen the actual resolution. And sorry in advance for everything I say that is where it is impossible to overlook that anyone who had seen this would have a much more informed take.
I guess we will issue the obligatory spoiler warning here at the top. Although, frankly, if you've seen enough of the show to understand its overall vibe and métier, then you understand already there will be no surprises in the finale. There is a clear trajectory that this entire show is building towards, and nothing will possibly get to stand in its way. But I'm very confused to hear that you watch enough of it that you only have the final episode left. And that's the point where you decided, this isn't for me. You know, I've seen enough. You would think at that point, some kind of sunk cost fallacy would kick in and you would at least put the hour in to close it out.
So old Colin absolutely would have done that. I stuck with so many shows for what eventually became clear to me was far too long, and I just found myself so regularly wishing I had bailed sooner. And the real turning point for me was Dexter. I watched every season of Dexter all the way through to the final year and just was so bored by the last season in particular, but the last couple, the last few maybe even, if we're being honest, that when it came to Dexter, I knew there were only literally four episodes left in the entire run of the show. That was going to be it. I was not going to have to commit to any future seasons under any circumstances. I'd already invested 100 episodes worth of time and certainly had rewatched many of those seasons. Seasons 1 and 4 of Dexter, incidentally, two of the finest seasons of TV ever made, along that kind of like genre. But the end game of it was just so bad that with those final four episodes remaining, I just said to myself, what is the point of wasting these 4 hours? And based on what I have heard about how Dexter ended up playing out, I have never regretted that whatsoever. And I honestly feel like that single decision has really granted me a lot of freedom as a TV viewer. And I think The Queen's Gambit is the ramification is the wrong word, Dom. Byproduct is the wrong word. What am I saying? It's just another instance of that.
I get it. And that's making a real statement. Watching enough of a show that it would make total sense for you to just finish it out. And some might argue that not finishing it doesn't really make any sense. But deciding to go and then quit at the 11th hour, I think is making really taking a principled stand against the entire point of the show there. Were you ever someone who walked out of a movie theater?
I recall one instance of us getting up and leaving, and that was when we went to see The Hills Have Eyes in, I'm going to say 2006, 2007, whatever version of it. I think that may have been a reboot of something older. I'm not even honestly sure. Don't know why we were there in the first place. None of us were big, like, horror kind of people. Couldn't make it through, I think, even the first hour of that before we were all very happy to leave. And then the other one where I was just bored out of my mind, despite a lot of like theoretically exciting things happening on screen, I got up to go get like a drink of water from the water fountain, and when I got back it was over and everyone was leaving the theater, and I did not care at all about having missed the ending, and that was Cloverfield.
Okay,
how about you?
I never really did, and so usually the barrier to doing that is if you're watching with someone in a theater, and it would be rude to just leave them or abandon them there. And especially if they like the movie a lot more than you apparently do, then that causes some tension there as well, maybe. But usually I would just be sneaking into the back of the movie theater by myself. And so sneaking out again would have been perfectly simple if I was so inclined. But that's a very natural impulse, I think, for a movie that isn't going anywhere for you, for a TV show as well. If you can bail after a few episodes, then it doesn't feel like a complete waste of your time. But on the scale of a show like Dexter or Lost, I think would be the perfect example, where having seen how that show ended, I think many viewers would have liked their 6 seasons and thankfully not yet a movie's worth of time in their life back after that.
Game of Thrones, I would say, has overtaken Lost.
Well, sure, but in a way, I feel like the ending of Game of Thrones was so bad that bonding over that became this communal experience and this cultural moment, where the fact that it so quickly disappeared completely from any cultural register is, I think, a worthy discussion point in itself for one of these segments before too long.
That is a good point. I mean, no one even talks about it anymore. We're just so ready to be past it.
Yeah, it's... If it was good, if it was even just half decent, given the amount of goodwill, the amount of fandom that people had for the show, then they could have stuck the landing, even if it was somewhat shaky towards the end there. And if it had like sucked a lot, then people would have just swept it under the rug and well, that's unfortunate, we don't need to talk about that show again. But the fact that it was so incredibly bad, like cartoonishly bad, outrageously bad, to the point where if you were trying to make a bad ending, you could not have really done worse than they did in practice, then that by itself becomes a piece of history. The fact that a show that had all of this momentum behind it just crashed and burned horrifically.
Yes, but sorry, where were you going about Lost and people potentially being able to commiserate is the word that I'm looking for.
Sure. I guess I'm just impressed by your ability to bail on things after such a lengthy time commitment, which I guess does not bode well for me if you ever get tired of what we have going on here. But in any case, let's get back to the main topic of this segment here, The Queen's Gambit, which I enjoyed enough to watch to the end and disagreed with the consensus on it enough to then write this lengthy screed about it. So I guess my feelings on it are actually somewhat complicated, and I'm still working those out through discussing the show, which is a great way to kind of pin down exactly what your thoughts are. But I'm ready to unleash you know, both barrels on the show.
Okay, so let me ask you about how you got into this show and what your expectations were. So Dom, how did you get into this show and what were your expectations going in?
Well, my origin story for the show is people wouldn't shut the fuck up about it. And so I decided to watch it, and it was on Netflix. It was on the front page because everyone else had been watching it already. And Netflix understood they had this cash cow they could milk for all it's worth and then take out back and shoot. And so I watched it, and it was good, but also bad. And more on that in a moment.
So yeah, what is it about the show that you feel like you've seen people raving about that did not resonate with you?
So the first thing that I don't quite understand is why this show would spark a chess boom, because the subject of the show is a chess prodigy. The show is about chess. There are so many scenes of her playing chess, studying chess, thinking about chess. Basically, everyone she opts to have in her life by choice is involved heavily in chess in some way. Her life is all about chess, and therefore the show is all about chess. But it doesn't need to be chess. It feels like chess is interchangeable with basically any other competitive pursuit. So if this were backgammon, for example, you could be substituted in for Beth Harmon with a backgammon craze, and the show would be basically exactly the same, as far as I could tell. Chess is a safe choice because it has this existing cultural cachet to it. So there are lots of people I know who maybe don't even know the rules of chess themselves, but they have a chess board in an attic somewhere. Or when they were kids and they were visiting their grandparents, then they would have this antique set that they would bring out and play a game on or something. So chess is part of the cultural conversation in a way that a lot of games simply would not be, even ones that might be popular in our circles or might be somewhat well known in general. Chess is the safest possible choice on that grounds, and it also offers a wide variety of real life parallels of stories to draw inspiration from that you can use as a model for the show. So Bobby Fischer, a lot of allusions in Beth's storyline to Fischer's life, but the contrast there, and this is the important thing for me, is that Bobby Fischer had too much personality. He was too vocal. He was the classic kind of torture genius who, because he is so good at one thing, gets away with treating people like absolute dog shit. People tolerate so much from him because he's good at chess, and that's the most important thing about him.
Was he that way when he was young?
Yes, absolutely. He always had this this drive, this intensity, this lack of concern for other people or awareness for other people, and not in like a caricatural villainish way for like totally from the outset. He was someone who could be very kind and very supportive and very, you know, he had this charisma to him that drove people towards him. It wasn't just the fact that he was good at chess, but that was the main thing, you know, and he was all about chess. And so, you know, if you were bad at chess, then you were a bad person. Or if you could not help him further his chess career, then you really didn't matter all that much to him in the end. And so it's quite easy to construct a story around Bobby Fischer's life because there are so many of these vivid real life events, stories of him you know, his match against Spassky was not only a massive cultural event and moment, it was the biggest tantrum on a global scale that we have seen until certain figures in recent years, perhaps. But he's someone who he feels like the safe choice himself. If you want to do a feature length portrait of this interesting character, Bobby Fischer's your man. And you know, there's a reason there are so many shows and movies about Fischer and not about Vichy Anand or any of the other like prominent chess figures from the past 40-50 years. Beth Harmon, the main character in The Queen's Gambit, exists on the absolute opposite end of that spectrum, where she appears to have no kind of outward personality and also no interior life at the same time. And that is a tough pill to swallow if you're trying to base your show around this character. And it would be one thing if the journey that she goes on is interesting in its own way, or if the people around her bring other aspects of the show to life. And you could frame it as this is Beth Harmon coming out of her shell, learning to trust other people, learning to enjoy parts of life other than chess. There are ways that you could use that as a bridge for character development, but instead, this is just who she is. She is fundamentally, she only really cares about chess. She plays a lot of chess. She's not interesting outside of that, and she isn't interested in people or things outside of chess. And so that's who she is. And it is somewhat common, I think, for people who are at the top of their field to have this absolute single-minded drive on this one passion to the exclusion and to the detriment of other areas in their life. That's not, I mean, not a good thing in general, but that also does not make for good TV. There is a reason that most of those people crash and burn in real life and also do not have a well-regarded, well-reviewed Netflix series made about them. They're setting themselves up for a tough challenge, and I think they fail to meet that challenge.
So one thing that really interested me in your written criticism here was the differences between the book and the TV series, and I think a pretty crucial one, if I'm understanding this correctly, is that Book Beth is not pretty, and she's not really engaging with anyone, and she's got a much potentially meaner streak even than TV Beth from time to time. And I thought that the performance delivered by, oh man, I have it written down, Anya Joy Taylor. Yeah, Anya Joy Taylor was one. Sorry, go ahead.
Anya Taylor Joy.
You're right. Yes, you are correct. And I thought that she did a really good job for what I thought they were going for, but I do now wonder if, and don't let me put words in your mouth here, but would you go so far as to say that the differences that potentially made the TV version of Beth more likable may have actually done a disservice to the overall story?
I would say exactly that, yeah. And you can, as soon as you scratch the surface of that, it already becomes somewhat troubling. So the big difference, as you allude to, that makes Beth more likable is that she is more attractive. And it's not just, upscaled the attractiveness of this character the way that is very common in basically any TV show or film or anything. It's replacing someone whose ugly duckling treatment by society is, and without the blossoming into a beautiful adult goose at the end, this is just an immovable facet of how she exists in the world. That's something which Book Beth has and defines her and is driven by that Show Beth absolutely does not have. And as I say, this isn't just Show Beth is a little more attractive than Book Beth. This is former model Anya Taylor-Joy, who, if she weren't this international sensation in the TV and film world before, surely will be now. And it's so jarring when you see, for example, there's a scene where a bunch of popular girls are kind of examining, interrogating Beth, trying to get the sense of who this girl actually is. And Book Beth, if this were true to life, so to speak, would be terrified of that situation, not just on top of her usual social anxiety or lack of social graces, but just she definitively is like lower status than them. Whereas Anya Taylor-Joy, when she is the prettiest girl by far in that group, then that power dynamic inevitably shifts around a bit. So the show kind of dodges some of those difficult questions or difficult scenes just by virtue of her magnetism. And she takes this quite lifeless script and injects her own verve and joie de vivre into it, which props to her for doing that. I mean, it's very impressive. And you can see why her performance is being routinely hailed, even by people who might dislike the show or take issue with other parts of it on the whole. But it is, I would say, the wrong or the lazy or the easy casting choice to kind of sweep a lot of that under the rug. But returning to the differences between Bookbeth and Showbeth, Bookbeth has a lot more rough edges. So on top of, you know, looking in the mirror every day, seeing how other people see her and just feeling repulsed in a way that Anya Taylor-Joy's Beth never could, because how would you? The character of Jolene is effectively whitewashed in the show, where instead of in the book, where they have this really messy upbringing together in the orphanage, where neither one of them acquits themselves well at all. And then when they reunite later on in, I think it's a finale, you may have seen this already yourself, not quite sure.
The end of episode 6 is Jolene showing back up at the door.
Right. She kind of swoops in down from heaven on her wings as a guardian angel, which she's not, you have to understand. The only thing she seems to care about is reassuring you that she is not the TV tropes page, which she assuredly is. she kind of swoops in from heaven to give Beth her life savings and her a newfound sense of confidence in herself and a pat on the back, and sends her on her way. And there's no sense of needing any kind of reconciliation, or maybe Beth has stuff that she needs to atone for or apologize for, or no real change in either of them beyond the characters that you saw much younger at the start of the series. It feels inevitable in the way that everything else in the show does, where of course the two of them are going to reunite as part of like this. It's almost like a montage in a superhero movie where the entire cast comes together and rallies around their hero or their heroine, and she's going to go off and slay the evil villain at the end. There's no sense of like tension or sacrifice or trade-offs in any of it. And so there's a big difference between Bookbeth and Showbeth. And if the character of Beth Harmon had just been invented from whole cloth, it would make sense if it was lacking in some places, because it is hard to create a compelling lead for a show like this. But you have source material, not just the real life source material where is Beth the female Bobby Fischer? Well, not really. But you also have literal source material that the show is built around and drawing inspiration from, in which the character of Beth is much more well developed and fleshed out than she is in the show. So something certainly is lost in translation there, and I'm not sure how much of that is a conscious choice, but given how pervasive that that simplification is throughout the entire show, it does seem like it must be conscious.
So quickly, as a side note here, Anya Josephine Marie Taylor Joy, Dom James Harvey, I know I have given you a hard time over the years for being a member of the Three First Names Club. We have a quintuple first name here, something I don't think I've ever encountered before.
That's Yahtzee. Yeah,
exactly. That is fantastic stuff there. But let me ask you, I feel like Netflix is a platform that would at least be open to a series along these lines that does not necessarily just fall pretty squarely into every cookie cutter along the way and have the kind of fairy tale ending. Do you feel like, even though I assume she still is successful in the chess world at the end of the book, do you feel like if this source material potentially were a bit darker, Netflix would have been better off going that route? Or do you feel like, and I mean from their perspective, or do you feel like the show with this kind of, with these, I guess, rose-colored glasses over it, is going to be what resonates with the larger audience?
I don't think that there was any kind of top-down directive from a network or a platform that was scared to show any darker side of Beth or anything like that. I think this was probably just a directorial choice that, at least for me, didn't really work at all.
Okay. And I'm definitely with you on that, not only in the in terms of like predictability and so forth. I was not too surprised to learn through context about pretty much anything that happened in the finale as I was reading your article there. But I also would say that probably the biggest issue for me, and I promise I do have things I liked about the show that we will certainly be getting to, but while we're on it, it felt like virtually all of the non-Beth characters were almost across the board pretty much one-dimensional in a way as to obviously impact Beth's trajectory either positively or negatively, but in just about the most heavy-handed manner imaginable.
Yeah, and even the character who is with her throughout most of the series and who changes in his relationship towards her the most over that time, in Benny, feels quite simple in his own right, where he goes from being this rival at the start to her friend in the middle and a mentor, mentee of sorts, and then her lover towards the end. But it's unclear, like, why they're drawn to each other in the first place, other than they're there and they're both good at chess. Like, where's the beef? Like, what more is there to it than that? And the show kind of balances this this fantasy world that it constructs, where it feels very safe and like Beth is just kind of surrounded in bubble wrap most of the time, with this realism where, yeah, it is, if you've been in any kind of competitive scene before, it's quite realistic that there are a bunch of people who will treat you a lot better than they would otherwise or that they have in the past, simply by virtue of you did well in a recent tournament or something, or, you know, you have a measure of clout or fame in that world, and then that becomes self-fulfilling because people just get drawn to you for that reason alone. Maybe because you have something you can give back to them or whatever. So it's this your parasocial transactional relationship. So it would make sense if Beth had a bunch of those people in her life. But we never really see that go awry at all. There's no sense of Beth either taking advantage of them or being taken advantage of, or any kind of, again, there's no like trade-off or sacrifice anywhere in there. It's just, hey, these people are in Beth's life and they help give her a gentle nudge on her inevitable rise towards stardom, and then they just fade from view and you never see them again.
I felt like, I first of all, totally with that, and I felt like, at least as far as I was concerned, the biggest missed opportunity in that respect was with Benny, and I don't mean that the guy did a bad job, although I will say it took me like 3 episodes of trying to figure out where I knew that guy from. And I was
I can tell you exactly where you know him from.
I looked it up. And so I hate looking that sort of thing up. I always want to quiz myself and eventually figure out what it is. After 3 episodes, I finally caved. It is not fair at all to make this one actor, he's like, what, 14, 15 or whatever in Game of Thrones, and now he's suddenly got a mustache and he's dressed like Christopher Lloyd in Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Like, I think he did a very good job, and Benny seemed like the person that I thought had the most room to kind of be an interesting, more complicated character. But I actually thought that, like, it would have potentially been more effective at selling him as this kind of oddball in the chess world if he weren't so outwardly an oddball within the chess world. It felt like they were going so far beyond what was necessary to make it clear that this guy is kind of like a rogue agent within this generally pretty straight-laced environment.
Yeah, you have this entire like pastel dreamland version of 1950s America, and then here comes Benny in his fedora and his leather boots, and you know, it really looks out of place, more so than he would anyway. I thought you were going to say you recognize him as Sam, the kid who was in love with his American classmate from Love Actually.
I did not. I mean, that must have been a long time ago. I mean, Love Actually is getting up there, and how old is that guy? I thought he was very young on Game of Thrones.
So Love Actually is from 2003. As you will learn if you listen to my podcast about Love Actually that I did with the great Melissa Sullivan, which will be dropping tomorrow as we record this, just as a Christmas treat. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah, this kid has I guess, gone places in the meantime, so good for him. But yeah, his character here just didn't do it for me. And there's no one else in the universe they construct, really, that fills that void for me. I'm not sure if Beth doesn't do it for you, who's your favorite character meant to be? Like, who else stands out? Who else carries the show on their back? I guess Jolene maybe is the next best hope for that. But again, she also is kind of a... sanded down and has an entire dimension removed basically in the show compared to the books,
and she's not on it for half of it.
Well quite, yeah. And even when the show, so for example, Beth is a young woman in a very male dominated environment, especially back in the 1950s, where any notion of inclusivity would have seemed quaint or alien at best. And early on, she meets the kind of blowback that you might expect from that. So she goes to a tournament and she gets these weird looks from everyone, and no one really takes her seriously or respects her as a competitor. And then as soon as she beats them for the first time, it's like a switch flips and their minds change, which does happen in some cases, but there's no sense that there's any like deeper struggle in that sense that she has to go through. It's as long as Beth is good enough at chess, any obstacle in her way will just fall down of its own accord, and there's nothing she has to do about it.
And another question I had along similar lines is, it also seems like as long as Beth has access to these tranquilizer pills, she can beat anyone in the world at chess. Is there ever any kind of like blowback from that? Is there any moral to take away other than do drugs?
That is a common trope with the genius character. Because it's very common in real life, is someone has this substance abuse or addiction, and that is the thing that can stop them from realizing their potential, and it's what maybe drives away some of the important figures in their life if the single-minded focus on chess or whatever it is hadn't already. So not surprised to see that worked in there, but in the wider context of the show, it feels like it's almost on this parallel track with her chess career, where even though she takes the tranquilizers to get better at chess and get in the right mindset for it, it feels like her rise to the top in chess is fairly effortless, but we need to introduce some kind of tension somewhere in theory, so let's have her have these complicated family dynamics, and let's have her get addicted to tranquilizers and so on, and that's going to be the character flaw, the singular character flaw that we choose to highlight.
Yeah, and I also was wondering, how necessary do you feel like it was that Beth kept winning at chess? And I guess not necessarily to go back to the same ideas, like, you know, could this have had like a tragic ending or whatever and still been as popular? But just in terms of, at least one problem for me was the idea that anyone in the world could essentially not really have played chess before. And yeah, I know they time lapse through a lot of her studying a bunch and practicing on the ceiling and whatever and playing against the janitor and so forth. But I mean, it is so far beyond ludicrous that anyone in the history of the world could go on any sort of like Beth Harmon run here. Do you feel like the story could have been equally compelling if she were making a run through like just a state tournament or whatever? And I bring it up because you know, you talked about Bobby Fischer's life story being interesting, and I think the only other, or at least the main other kind of chess movie or TV show that people would be familiar with is Searching for Bobby Fischer, which is not about Bobby Fischer. It's about also a child prodigy, but it's not like he's becoming the best player in the world. He's just like winning some junior championship somewhere.
Right, and so the scope of Beth's meteoric rise is far larger than it is in any of those other stories in a similar space. And in real life, that has happened, to my understanding. Like, not just Bobby Fischer himself, who basically, as soon as he was playing in adult competitions, was just the best until he quit. But, you know, Magnus Carlsen, the wonder kid of chess in the modern era.
Right, and these are people who dedicate their entire childhood to chess.
So there's that, first of all. Yeah, like if by the time Beth is getting to age 12 or whatever, it's already too late to be this.
Exactly.
And actually, one of the more high-profile female players in Judith Polgar was a literal test case in this, because her father wanted to explore the role of nature versus nurture in raising not just chess prodigies, but genius kids as a whole. And so he set his kids on this rigorous chess training regimen from very early on. It was always the end game for him that his kids would become chess experts. And Polgar did. You know, she was incredibly successful. But I guess the clearly ethical dilemmas at work there as well. But also, that is the focus that you need in order to excel in this way. It's not like you can come to the game as an adult and ever really be in the same league as the kids who were these prodigies and then became adults, by my understanding.
I'm on her Wikipedia. She broke Bobby Fischer's record. And sorry if you just said this. She broke Bobby Fischer's record as the youngest person to become a grandmaster.
Of course she did, yeah. But you, as you said, you haven't watched the last episode yourself, but you don't need to know what happens, right? Like there's no suspense in your mind over what the final outcome here is going to be.
Right, and that's why I didn't end up watching it. I was open to the possibility, I guess, that it could have ended in some heartbreaking way, but it really didn't seem like it was going that route. And at this hour, I still don't really regret not having seen it. But Dom, I definitely feel like we are not giving the show credit where it is certainly due. And while I am open to further complaints down the line, I definitely want to flag up some things that we enjoyed about this as well. Because I'm confident there are things to be getting into here. And the first of those for me is the visual element here. I think it is underratedly, honestly, difficult to do specifically like mid-20th century in color in a convincing and compelling way. Like the era where it's basically like modern human life, but also distinctly old-timey, I think is such a tough balance to pull off.
Yeah, and they completely nail that aesthetic. The world building here, in a visual sense, is spectacular. And that's what contributes for me to this almost dreamlike quality that the series has, where it does feel like a dream at some points, where you're in this world which feels slightly unreal, that there's something a bit off about it, a bit unnatural. You can't quite pinpoint what it is, but in every other aspect, it's a beautifully realistic rendition of things that you're familiar with.
I think this honestly may be a show that benefited a lot from not being attempted sooner. I don't think that it would have been nearly as appealing if they had to use like visual effects from 2005 or whatever, and even more recently than that, maybe even like 2015 might even have been a stretch.
Honestly, I think you can say that about a lot of the highly acclaimed dramas nowadays, where so many of them, even if they don't explicitly bask in their visual component the way that the Queen's Gambit does, the fact that they can create this very visually captivating world means that sometimes it's, you know, there's less work required to hook the audience in and keep their attention, because if the storyline itself ever lulls for a moment, they're just kind of hypnotized by the beautiful surroundings and backdrop. And so in some sense, it relieves the pressure on them to keep things snappy and to keep things moving, which is a good thing in some ways. It does give them more time to let their storylines breathe and develop organically. But it does also mean that sometimes it's so easy for your appreciation of the world you're seeing to spill into, oh, therefore what I'm seeing is artistically strong, which is not always the case.
I also want to say, I think for the right kind of person, this is a show I would recommend. It's just not the kind of show for me, and I definitely would not have thought, Dom, that it would be necessarily the kind of show for you. But I'm not at all surprised that it is very popular. And to actually go back to something that you flagged up earlier, when talking about chess just kind of regaining popularity here, I think it is worth mentioning that chess itself is just a very interesting game that grabs people's attention and compels them to potentially look a bit further into. And that's why it's stuck around for so many thousands of years. One of the oldest games known to mankind, I believe, although not older than the actual oldest game known to man, which is backgammon. And by the way,
There it
Netflix,
is.
please do backgammon next. Please generate some interest in backgammon. That game needs an influx of fish ASAP.
Let's
But
get a 7-part biopic about Ian Terry's backgammon career and see if we can tap the tank at all.
but
But
do you disagree with the idea that is this just never a show you would recommend to anyone?
no, I would absolutely recommend it to people, but I would recommend it first and foremost as this feel good TV, as this kind of
Yeah.
fantasy, more so than this grand artistic vision that's getting realized. And I think it does have use as a fantasy, like in a world which seems darker and more dire by the day, to have a fictional universe in which, by and large, people are good to each other and success comes somewhat easily. And people have so many opportunities in the show to screw each other over, screw Beth over, to just kind of not go the extra mile to help people out. And without fail, they basically do. And even the ones who are assholes at the start or are skeptics become believers by the end. They're converted to the cause. And so, yeah, I can see why, if I'm taking off my cynical lens here, people say that the show is relatable because you want the show to be relatable. You want this to be a reflection of how you achieve success in the real world, where you don't really have to put any effort into other people, but you get a lot back from them. And also, you just glide to the top of your chosen field without anything really standing in your way. Like, I want that to be relatable. I want to have that be my life story. I can see why people are drawn to that.
Yeah. One other thing in reading the Wikipedia that I thought was interesting, or a couple things actually from the Wikipedia. But first of all, the music. They ended up going with a full orchestra, and I'm certainly never going to complain about a full orchestra soundtrack. But they apparently were originally at least considering the idea of going with just piano, and I actually really like that idea. First of all, just because I feel like the visual element. Maybe I'm now trying to talk myself into this being a fitting word, but I feel like the softness that they used in a lot in the kind of like grays and those tones that they ended up using went a long way. And I felt like, and now in thinking about it, felt like a piano only score would have been really fitting with that kind of atmosphere. And furthermore, I also would have, I think, liked the, maybe symbolism is the wrong word, but I like the tie-in between the black and white of the chessboard and just the black and white piano keys. I thought could have at least potentially been there.
You'll be a literary critic before you know it, Colin.
All right. I also wanted to say, in terms of things that I did like about it, all of the actors really did a good job as far as I was concerned. I'm not, I don't have the best critical eye in that regard, but I liked the characters I was supposed to like. I thought the people who sadly just kind of had one dimensional negative roles did a convincing job in those roles. I'm not going to hold it against them that they didn't have a ton of meat to really chew on in a lot of cases there, but I do want to be really clear that the effort that went into all of this from not only the actors, but the visual element, the musical element, all along the way, I think did work really well for what they were going for. It's just what they were going for did not work well for me. And yeah, did any of the actors, I was wondering though, Dom, stand out to you?
I think all of them did pretty good jobs of what they were given. Naturally, Anya Taylor-Joy steals the show. Hard for her not to, given that she is the main character and everything really does revolve around her in this world. But you're okay with that, watching Anya Taylor-Joy bring that character to life, even though the script that she's working with doesn't really fit together.
One other thing, Dom, that I liked from the Wikipedia is learning that they brought in one of the all-time greats from the world of chess, excuse me, prior to the aforementioned Magnus Carlsen coming along. I think he was the consensus greatest of all time. Garry Kasparov was a consultant on this show, and my first thought was, I'm almost surprised that he was willing to take it on, given the kind of ease with which she is able to maneuver her way through the chess world. It seemed like almost a slap in the face to people who have actually had to do that and understand that it takes an entire lifetime of constant grinding to get anywhere near that point. But
they actually wanted him to be Borgov initially, her final boss at the end of the series.
He's so way too recognizable.
Yeah, that's what he said. And also, he's a busy guy, can't take that much time off of filming. But that really would have driven the point home of, like, I had to work so much harder than this. Yeah, why couldn't this have been my route to the top?
I mean, I think the very natural impulse there would be people saying, oh, she's playing against Garry Kasparov. Now, how did she time travel to the 70s, 80s, and 90s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... liked that, though, that it may have been the case that he was like, well, if this is going to get made anyway, we may as well have them do the most technically accurate job that they can do. And
I believe they also had Bruce Pandolfini of the aforementioned Searching for Bobby Fischer, who, you know, it's good to have expert consultants like that, because so many chess scenes in TV and film are just, if you know anything about chess, are just impossible to watch, because the logical impossibilities of what you're seeing on the board, just you can't help but notice that. The same way that medical staff watching House or whatever, you know, it's really hard to actually immerse yourself in the show you're seeing and not have that jolt you out of it. So it's good that they had those guys on board. And from what I understand from chess experts who themselves evaluated the show on those grounds, it seemed like they did a pretty good job.
Yes, that is what I read as well, and definitely do want to say a big time to be fair here. I have never in my life seen a movie or TV show accurately depict what it is like actually playing poker, and I would imagine that is probably the case in many, many, many lines of work as well. I'm sure cops and lawyers and doctors have to deal with this all the time in terms of just being frustrated by how unrealistic everything looks on TV and in movies. So fully acknowledge that this is not at all an outlier in this respect, and if anything, may be the absolute standard here, and we would be crazy to expect anything else there.
Are you saying that official top three Colin Stone movie rounders did not accurately depict what it's like to be in the poker trenches?
So rounders, I mean, literally does not go one scene without being completely unbelievable, where like any one person who has been successfully paying their way through law school by playing poker is never in their life hole rolling some underground game.
Well, this is what I mean about like a show starting a boom for a particular activity. Like, okay, I'm sure rounders drew a bunch of people to poker, but how many of those people realized as soon as they got there that this actually isn't at all like what the film promised me?
I honestly feel like I see people all the time who still don't register that it's not like that. Well, they still think they're gonna just cooler their way to the main event.
I guess that's why the games are still good.
Yeah, they're going to be able to just look at the guy across the table and know when to fold top two pair heads up on the flop or whatever. It is completely unfathomable.
Is that the secret to your success? Is they can't soul read you because there's no soul to be read?
Yeah, and they also still haven't seen through my clever ploy to just keep buying them Oreos, and they're just giving it all away. So
your indoor sunglasses are masking your eyes?
Yes. So, Dom... what other things? I'm sure I'm rushing you through some other things that you wanted to get through here. So what are some other takeaways that you had from the Queen's Gambit?
Oh, I'm good. And feel free to rush me. You know, we're 50 minutes in at this point. But if you want more detail, then I do recommend, if I may say so myself, checking out my piece once again over on myentertainmentworld.ca, or you can find the link to that on my Twitter feed at DomHRV. But I have a sense there may be some other questions you want to ask me here today.
There is, although let me quickly say, sorry to disrupt an otherwise flawless segue, Dominic. big time shout out. As far as our chess background goes, is certainly due at this point to Jerry over at Chess Network, a guy who streams on Twitch and posts videos on YouTube. I would strongly recommend that if anyone, as far as I could tell, pretty much any kind of level of chess player would be interested in learning more about the game, Jerry at Chess Network is, Chess Network would be the thing to be searching in the relevant locations. For sure, number one, at the very least in my heart, and I have never encountered anyone who does a better job of making chess coverage really entertaining and informative for people of, again, just any kind of skill level. Dom and I have both spent at least a reasonable amount of time watching Jerry cover tournaments and bonded over that in the very early years of knowing each other.
If you ever hear us say the words back to tournament, that is our shout out to the two other Jerry fans who are out there listening.
Yes. I definitely wanted to throw that out there as well. I'm sure there is a 0% chance he will ever hear this, but we are both diehard Jerry believers, and definitely do give him a look if you are a chess person in any respect. But Dominic, you are correct. I do have a slightly unrelated question here, debatably related. As it has begun snowing here in New England, albeit a bit intermittently compared to what I was used to growing up as a young lad here, I have begun thinking a lot more about the quality of the various seasons that we experience from year to year. And I know one of the topics that is always at the forefront of every kind of social media debate, Dom, today we're going to be discussing the four seasons ranked, and to immediately get to my number four, as I'm guessing people can anticipate at this point, winter is trash. Where are you on winter?
I am pro winter. I will defend winter to the day I die with my frostbitten fingers. You will have to pry winter out of my cold, dead hands. So let's examine the root of our disagreement here. What is it that you fail to appreciate incorrectly about winter?
So this is the thing. It is worth noting for me, as the person making these rankings, that I don't leave my apartment all that often for any reason other than to get in my car and go be indoors other places. So other than like going on walks, I'm not outdoors too often, and winter makes going on walks extraordinarily annoying. So that I think is an immediate deduction there for winter. And then furthermore, while I used to be an avid snowboarder and skier and certainly see the value in those activities, they are both immensely fun. It has been a long time for me personally since I have been in either of those games. And once out of those games, I have not really found much use for snow.
Okay. And since I moved to Canada, I have had to gain a newfound appreciation for what snow can do to your life. But I see where you're coming from. My rebuttal to that would be that in the actual worst season, Colin, which is summer, going outside and also staying inside are both ordeals in their own way. So you go outside and you're scorching, you're sweating, you're begging for the sweet release of death or just air conditioning, you know, whichever is within closer reach. But then as soon as you get back inside, unless the place you're going to has great AC as well, you will just be sweating like a pig. You know, I don't need to be dripping, you know, in my underwear or whatever when I'm at home just desperately looking for any kind of comfort. Whereas at least in winter, even if it is freezing outside, usually you can create a kind of nice comforting bubble for yourself inside, you know, maybe a nice crackling fire or just a thick blanket, whichever's easiest for you.
So I definitely agree with the overall point there, which is being cold is superior to being too hot, because at least when you're cold, you can put on layers for the most part, whereas when it's too hot, there's just very little you can do about it without air conditioning at your disposal. And I have certainly found myself at points in my life where being too hot was absolutely brutal. And I'm fully with you on that. I think the issue for me is just what a difference the snow makes. And without tipping the other three rankings that I have remaining, which I'm sure everyone is on the edge of their seat about, winter was such a distant fourth, and the other three were all extremely close as far as I'm concerned, just by virtue of not being winter. So I'm certainly willing to hear arguments against any of the others.
Okay, so what would your arguments be against spring and or autumn, which is autumn, by the way, not fall, not quite sure what that is. How would you distinguish between the non-winter seasons there?
So this is essentially what it came down to for me, which is spring, summer, and fall slash autumn. I'll give you autumn. I'm also not clear on why it's called fall. Maybe the leaves are falling and that's what it's all about. Not interested in spending much time on the etymology there. The distinguishing factors for me were as follows. I had fall slotted in here, excuse me, autumn slotted in here at number three, and am honestly a bit nervous about that ranking, but the main reason is I'm a huge fall guy. The problem is that fall only lasts like 2 weeks now in New England, and again, I apologize for not calling it autumn. This is going horribly. And that kind of getting my hopes up, only for it to be immediately dashed year after year, places it below two otherwise very good seasons.
Okay, so is spring the contender here? Like, where do you fall on spring? Or where do you autumn on spring?
Yeah, I had spring at number one, summer number two, just because, as you mentioned, absolutely a problem of getting too hot and not being able to do anything about that. That is not ideal, and I am never going to argue with anyone who puts autumn ahead of summer or spring. I think many, many cases can be made for any of these other three seasons that do not contain snow and freezing cold temperatures, and I think it's on a case-by-case basis probably going to have a lot to do with, you know, what line of work people are in and what, if they're into TV shows that are on at certain times of year or whatever they're into, you know, movies come out in the summer a lot more, and maybe that's a determining factor. I'm certainly open to anyone having any of these other three at number one, but for me, I put spring at number one just because it's like summer, but without nearly the same degree, pardon the pun, of getting overheated, and that I feel like is essentially just summer minus the only negatives of summer.
Yeah, I think spring has the best of all worlds. Essentially, the thing that marks it down for me is its close proximity to summer, where it's tough to enjoy spring knowing that summer is as close as it's ever going to get. Summer's just around the corner, whereas as soon as we get into autumn, it is as far as you can possibly be from summer, and you can rest on your bed of leaves and revel in that fact.
Oh, trust me, every year when I turn off my air conditioner for what I know is going to be the final time, I think to myself, oh God, here we go again. I can't believe I'm about to do another winter in New England. And genuinely, Dom, like, my goal in life is to someday move to a place that doesn't have snow. But I think that is probably because I grew up here in New England, where we were, at least back then, getting dumped on all the time. And we had like double digit snow day sweats every year in childhood. And it was a lot of fun waking up and finding out that school was canceled. But these days, it seems like we only get a few big snowstorms every so often, and then a bunch of rain pretty much to wash it away in the weeks in between those. Can't imagine what might be going into all of that. Probably just a coincidence. But Dom, I grew up in New England. You grew up in Old England. What is winter like there? Were you not getting a bunch of snow?
Well, I'm sure Australia will welcome you with open arms if and when you decide to take
Can't
the
wait. Genuinely 100% down.
I fully support you in that life choice. But back in ye old England, we didn't have snow to anywhere near the same degree. Like, if you lived in England and you thought snow was annoying or disruptive then, you should come and visit Canada, honestly, because it is like a whole different universe over here. But back in England, you would get the occasional dribble of snow. You know, England would dabble in a little snow every now and then, and it would completely paralyze the country, basically. It's one inch of snow and you know, half the trains would get cancelled. They would break out the trucks to start gritting the pavement, even though there really was no need yet. People could manage. There was just this fear of what snow could do, and it was somewhat sensible, I think, to not anticipate it or not know how to handle it, because it didn't really come around that often. And when it did, usually it would be gone or just turn into some like wet, sludgy, after product before too long. Honestly, winters in England are more dark, cold, and drab and wet than anything else. And that, depending on your constitution, may be even worse than snow. You know, if you have a SAD within you, then yeah, I think that might actually be a worse place to be on those grounds.
I was going to ask if you could magically teleport to England just for the winters, if that would be worth it. But it sounds like Canada may be worth the snow.
The answer is no, because I would be back in England, and you know, no one wants that. But yeah, so definitely good arguments against winter, no matter where you're from. I don't think I've seen anyone have a bad word to say about spring, although I'm sure there are contrarians out there who could correct me on that.
Yeah, I'm sure there are edgelords out there who are somehow anti-spring, but one of the main things actually that I thought spring had going for it is kind of the inverse of what you were saying about autumn, which is spring rolls around, the snow is melting, and you know it's not coming back. Never further away from the next time that you have to scrape your car off before you leave the house. Absolute elation every single year when I walk outside for the first time in shorts and flip-flops and can say, we've made it.
Yeah, and so if you share my view on this, then you share that same terror during spring when you see the thermometer creep up over time and you can sense it's getting hotter and you think, maybe I should wear shorts out today instead of trousers or pants, I guess, where you come from. And these ominous signs that summer is just around the corner will fill you with a sense of foreboding and dread.
I don't know if I've ever seen you wear shorts.
I don't think you've ever seen me wear shorts either, come to think of it.
So... TBD on maybe that playing a role in your disdain for summer, Dom. I might suggest finding some more breathable attire this year.
Look, let's say I were to wear shorts during the summer, I would still be boiling because that's how summer works. Whereas in winter, you know, as you get some earmuffs on, you cover those up, protect them real good, you put on another coat or another shirt or whatever, and you can ensure yourself against the worst of what's going on around you. Simply not possible in summer. You have to grin and bear it.
Okay, so I'm placing winter at an inarguable number 4 for me. Where is it falling for you in your grand scheme of rankings here?
I think it actually would still be number 3, just because spring and autumn have most of the benefits of winter. I'm not someone who goes snowboarding or whatever, so I don't need it to be at that extreme. But also, they don't have the worst of winter, which is, you know, I don't need to list it. So I would have summer at 4, winter at 3, and then it's a close run thing between spring and autumn for the first 2 slots. But that would definitely be my order for sure.
Okay. I'm positive that there are plenty of people out there who are furious at us for all of this winter slander. So let me at least do some slight kind of making up there. And this is not pandering. This is a completely sincere take here. I am a firm believer, Dom, that the Winter Olympics are way better than the Summer Olympics. There are such better sports on in the Winter Olympics. Winter at least has that, I guess, going for it. Dom, anything else for... Oh, one other thing that we should at least note for the historical record, because it's too good not to. Even knowing that this is probably going to pretty seriously date this podcast, the Four Seasons total landscaping thing is definitely yes. Worth bringing up here, at least at the very end of this podcast, because that was the absolute funniest possible way the whole Trump administration could close.
I do agree with you that the Winter Olympics are so much better normally than the Summer Olympics. And part of that is the Winter Olympics know why they're there. They are conclusively about winter. They're set in winter. Whereas the Summer Olympics, I guess it happens during the summer because, hey, why not? It's the best tourist season. But that is just a hodgepodge of every possible event that could be called a sport underneath the sun, we're going to have an Olympic contest in it. Whereas the Winter Olympics, I feel like the bar is a lot higher. You know, you really have to know what you're going for.
Yeah. Did you see... I don't even know how much truth there is to this, but I heard that Pauly Calafiore was trying to become an Olympic bobsledder.
I believe that Pauly Calafiore believes that he's trying to become an Olympic bobsledder, but, you know.
Yeah.
But TBD on whether that's going to amount to anything.
Anyway, big time shout out to Four Seasons Total Landscaping. That was...
Yes.
Honestly, better than anything the Veep writers themselves could have come up with. Just perfection there. So
this goes back to what I say about when the reality outstrips the possibility for satire, then what do you do if you're a comedian? You really are snookered at that point.
Yeah.
But also I want to throw honorable mention to the Four Seasons by Vivaldi, you know, a set of concertos, which I'm sure you, as a classical music aficionado, have a deep and abiding appreciation for. How do you rank the four of those? Are you a spring man? Are you more partial to summer or autumn?
Big autumn guy. Thanks for asking.
The correct answer is spring is number one with the bullet, because that is the only one that anyone has ever heard. And I'm sure you have heard it, because it is a very common piece used in like period dramas or whatever, just to set the scene, because, you know, we have to remind people that this is some like fussy British aristocratic institution, and what better way to do that than to play some Vivaldi. And it also just, it's a banger, you know, it's just a great piece of music. Whereas if you played Summer for me right now, I'm not sure I could tell you where it was from.
So pretty heroic of me then to be out here campaigning on behalf of autumn to get some exposure there.
Yeah, you're always fighting for the underdog.
Yes, indeed. All right, Dom, Queen's Gambit, four season rankings. Anything else from you?
I'm all out, I think.
All right, I am as well. So thank you, everyone, who has made it this far. We will be back next week with, not sure yet, recording these a little early still, and not sure what order they're going up in, but certainly back next week with something. So we will talk to you guys then. Take care, everybody.